That is part of their problem. They they can't fill their vacancies.
Really was of officials using excessive force, not just using excessive force, but using it for a long period of time. But the other side is also true, where you have an inmate of inmates, violence. That forces, that not forces, how do we deal with it? We have all sorts of these. So we will need to balance it, because we are often accused or requested by the department not to only focus on what officials are doing, but to focus on the entire environment. They work in a very difficult environment, and there's no excuse for them to do what they're doing. But when we deal with it, let's deal with that balance question, and then hopefully a South African find a response to what is happening. Bearing in mind that we have an environment of overcrowding, an environment of power differences, if you could put it that way. You have vulnerable people, youth, first time offenders, versus people that have been in the system for many, many years, leaders of gangs. We have officials that are institutionalized, probably become part of what is happening there. You have new officials that have come from college straight into the system. If you look at the incident in Kimberley, for instance, where four young ladies were taken hostage by inmates, all those things that we want to talk about. But at the end of the day, how do we address the question of torture in correctional services, because that's our area of jurisdiction. So that's what we'll be focusing on. If you can narrow the correctional services and assist us as oversight committee in dealing with that. Once again, welcome to everybody. We have scheduled 30 minutes according to Cindy for your presentation. If you can do shorter than that, or the better, give us more time to discuss. And we schedule to get out of this place at 1 o'clock. Hopefully by 1 o'clock we'll be able to wrap up. Can I hand over to the South African Human Rights Commission?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. My name is Judith Cohen. I'm the head of the program, Department of International Affairs at the Director of Human Rights Commission. I'm joined today by a colleague, Fadla Adams, who is a researcher in the program and who focuses most of the time on issues of torture and the work which the Commission does around with torture. Before I begin, I would like to say we do have a member of our delegation who unfortunately cannot be with us this morning. Our Deputy Chairperson, Chris Gallander, was due to join us this morning. She took ill overnight and is really just not in a state to be here today, which is most unfortunate. We have had a lengthy meeting with her yesterday in preparation. And I will begin with a few of the comments which she intended making, knowing that I probably can't do it as eloquently as she would have. Also, just before I begin, just to say thank you to this committee in a busy time schedule for making the time available and for this meeting to take place. What we are discussing today is a very serious matter, serious for the Commission, but we really appreciate, I think, the tone that has already been set today by the chairperson as to where these discussions that should lead, and really to focus on solutions, the way forward, and what it is that we must get done. Just to let you know, where are we going in terms of what I will be speaking about this morning? I will briefly run through why we are there. I will then give some context and background as to why it is that the Human Rights Commission is concerned around this matter. And obviously, discussing torture is concerned, but I'm going to be fleshing that out a bit in terms of our role as a national human rights institution. so that members can really firmly understand where we are coming from and where we raise these issues. I'm also going to look just very briefly at the Makana matter within the context of South Africa and how it conducts itself at an international level to try and bring some perspective to this committee in terms of how these matters are handled, the country's experience. And then I will go through and turn more to so what is it that we could be doing, what is the role in terms of Parliament, its oversight role, in terms of its legislative role, in terms of what is it that we could do to improve our human rights architecture in this country to avoid incidents such as Makana. And lastly, just before I begin, I think very often when an incident of torture has occurred, one, no matter who you are in the country, you are often very deeply shocked. It's often something one does not feel proud about. But to say incidents of torture occur in every single country in the world, we are not unique in South Africa. And the debate is about what do we do about it to prevent it. And that is really where the focus of our discussions need to be today. So having said that, just in terms of the Makana matter, and just in order that for those members who are not familiar with it, just to say this is a matter that found itself before the Human Rights Committee at the United Nations. McCallum used the individual complaints mechanism contained in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which South Africa is a signatory. And in terms thereof, once one has exhausted all domestic remedies, you are entitled to approach the Human Rights Committee in Geneva for them to hear your matter. And I'm going to come back and say a little bit more about that. But just before I can begin, just to run through very quickly for those of you who are not familiar with the matter. At a time session on the 25th October 2010 in Geneva, the UN Human Rights Committee found that South Africa as a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights had violated its obligations in terms of the convention. This followed the 2005 incident at St. Albans Prison, where wardens locked down a high security facility for 3 days and allegedly inflicted horrific abuse on inmates. The alleged assault was seen as retribution for the murder of the unit manager of the maximum security section. The suspect was arrested for the killing of his son. On 15 November 2006, South Africa appeared before the UN Committee Against Torture, the different committees on the Human Rights Committee, but also in Geneva, the UN. During this session, a member of the South African delegation claimed that on the date of the murder in St. Albans Maximum Correctional Facility, the officials were overcome with the situation and assault took place. All allegations of assault have since been denied by the government. On the date of the incident, approximately 50 wardens had forced the inmates strip naked and lied on the western floor of the prison corridor, forming a human chain. The inmates were positioned in a manner where they were placed face to anal cavity of the inmate in front of them. If they looked up, they were beaten with batons and kicks. The inmates were subjected to severe beating with shock shields, boomsticks, pool cues, pickaxe axe handles, and batons. Around 20 female wardens were allegedly present and allegedly walked over the inmates, kicking them in their genitals while making crude remarks. The complainant McCadden claimed they'd been raped for the batons. The inmates were sprayed with water and beaten with shock balls. as a result of the shock, inmates were naked and defecated on themselves and those linked to them on the senior chain. After several hours, they were ordered to return to their cells, wet with water, urine, feces, and blood. This created chaos as inmates fell over each other and thus incurring further injuries. During the incident, McCullum had been forced down in a way that dislocated his jaw and damaged his teeth. McCullum's teeth were eventually removed, which detrimentally affected his diet and his health, and his request for teeth prosthesis was ignored. A third punishment was that inmates were prohibited from communicating with their family or legal counsel for approximately 1 month after the incident, thus they were held incommunicado. McCullum and other inmates were prevented from seeing a doctor for more than 2 months. They were further deprived of free HIV testing and adequate medical treatment for injuries incurred during the incident. As a result, inmates resorted to treating their wounds themselves with ash as disinfectant and bags to stop the bleeding. When McCullum eventually visited the prison hospital in September, he claimed that the doctor refused to administer treatment to him, stating that his wounds were the result of an internal matter. McCullum allegedly reported the incident to prison authorities, to the office of the inspecting judge, and to the Protestant Service. However, no investigation ensued. McCullum brought proceedings to the magistrate court, but the state denied the allegations. The action was withdrawn, and proceedings were later instituted in the High Court. However, the state relied on legislation that required proceedings to be brought against the state in its organs within 6 months. McCullum alleges that this provision would defeat his action in the High Court. After several unsuccessful attempts to report the alleged incident to the relevant authorities, counsel for McCullum has made to the Human Rights Committee. I think what it needs to be noted is that almost 300 inmates have since filed a civil case with the Federal High Court for liberation due to the pain and suffering caused as a result of the incident. I think that is very important that what occurred there is this was not one person. Please got to the end of speaking about the matter because I want to speak at many people in the room. So that is for anyone who's not familiar with the matter that's taken directly from the correspondence which was issued by the United Nations. I think though what is important is for the community to understand why the Palestinian Human Rights Commission is taking action and pursuing this matter so vigorously and to place it within context. Not only do we as the Human Rights Commission receive our mandate from the Constitution, which sets out what it is that we must do, in addition to that, at an international level, we are recognized as a national human rights institution. And in terms of that, and in terms of the recognition which we receive from the Office of the High Commission in Geneva, we are incumbent and we have obligations in terms of something called the Paris Principles to do certain things. And in terms thereof, it has become very clear that it is the role and the duty of the national institution to follow up on matters when there has been an individual complaint at the United Nations level. So in terms of the Commission carrying out what we are doing here today, it is not only in terms of our constitutional mandate, but it's also in terms of our mandate because we are recognized at an international level as being the national institution. And a number of high commissioners have even stated that they regard us as the national institution as their partner at the domestic level to assist them in following up and asking questions around what it is that has happened. So, pursuant to to these obligations. That is why, after having received the matter, studied the ethics, and looked at it, and to mention when we as a commission look at it, it is not just the case of saying what happened to one individual and McCallum. It's asking a series of questions. What went wrong and what did not work that this matter could get all the way to the international level? I think everyone agrees that incidents of torture should not occur, but it is embarrassing for a country, for all of us as citizens of this country, when the matter that is referred to is being discussed at an international level for everyone to see what is happening. And therefore, it really is incumbent upon us to ensure we are a vibrant democracy, we have many institutions, we have a strong legal framework, but something has gone wrong when a matter can get all the way up to the international level. And I think having said that, one can look and ask how many matters have got to the international level. From South Africa, there are some countries who have many matters that get to the international level. In fact, you find the individual complaints mechanisms of the United Nations that are used. It's very often persons from your more developed countries where there is greater access to justice who have the resources to get their matters to the UN that take matters there. However, one is seeing more and more matters coming from the countries that are not that well resourced and that matters are getting there. And I think, therefore, it is concerning, and one needs to ask the question, well, if one matter got there from South Africa, the chances are, there's a probability that this is potentially not an isolated incident, and that there are incidents of torture, ill-treatment occurring in our prisons from time to time. Just in case you're interested, South Africa has had two matters that have made their way all the way through to the United Nations. The other one was a whole a matter I can speak about in front of our young people. That was a young man called Gareth Wilson. A lot of people know about this case. He was a Rastafarian in terms of his religion. He indulged in smoking marijuana. He completed studying for his law degree and then made application to become a lawyer. The Cape Law Society found that he was not a fit and proper person to be a lawyer. And he pursued the matter all the way through the Supreme Court of Appeal, Constitutional Court, Acting Commissioner of Human People's Rights, and again, the same committee that McCallum appeared before. And in all cases, he was not successful. So this is the first time a finding has been made by a committee at the UN level against South Africa. And I think that is why it's also important that all of us work together to ensure that it receives the response that it deserves to receive. In that, should matters in the future go to the UN, we need to also learn from this matter in terms of how we deal with such things. I think what is concerning, and I know particularly our Commissioner Danny Titus always points to this, and also Commissioner Chris Gunn always pointed this out today. What is particularly concerning is that the South African government failed to respond at the international level. This is deeply concerning. On five occasions, over a 22-month period, the South African government was asked to respond. The opportunity was given for the South African authorities to give their version of what did or did not occur on five occasions. And I think the concern for the commission is, and I think it's a concern parliament is the extent to which South Africa takes its international obligations seriously. One is bound by having signed these international obligations to respond when the matters are placed before the committee. And I think it goes further than that. It's not just the case in terms of this individual complaint, but the Human Rights Commission in Parliament and its annual reports on many platforms is currently engaging with the Department of International Relations has been pointing out that in terms of our reporting obligations at an international level, we are not matching up a good track record as we said. Many of our other TGW reports that are due to the UN are overdue. And in fact, most of the major TGW, except for CEDAW, because we appeared before them earlier this year, we are overdue. And in some cases, and particularly with the Human Rights Committee, the matter where the McCallum matter was heard, the report for this committee has been outstanding since March 2000. And bearing in mind that a South African is chairperson of this committee, Dr. Zonke Magidina, the former deputy chair of the South African Human Rights Commission, is chairperson of this committee. And I'm sure, and you know that you must be asked, like, what is going on? Why has South Africa not sent this report? And I'm saying this because when one travels to the UN, these are the kinds of questions which are asked. I think I'm going to move on to what it is, and let's start looking at solutions in terms of what it is. And I think that, again, in terms of the international framework, our obligations, we can learn from them. The first is South Africa has a strong constitution to state that torture is not permissible. However, what we have not done in South Africa, and many people are often very surprised when they hear this, we have not criminalized torture. We have not created a specific offense of torture. So, for example, in the McCallum matter, if the perpetrators had or were brought before a criminal court, they would be charged with assault, for example, but they would not be charged with torture. And it is an obligation which South Africa has committed to, by signing the Convention Against Torture, that we will have torture legislation. And we can share with the committee that the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development that is responsible for processing this legislation has had a draft form for many, many years. I think going back to 2003 was when we first saw one of the first drafts. So there is a draft. None of the South Africa has not done anything, but that draft needs to be followed up on and it needs to be brought to Parliament. And I think that is a role that this committee can play in terms of engaging with the other committees in Parliament to ensure that that legislation is prioritized and brought to Parliament. Because not only is it an obligation in terms of the Convention Against Torture, but when South Africa appeared before the Committee Against Torture, when we appeared at the UN for the Universal Periodic Review, it was recommended to South Africa that we comply with our obligations and that we criminalize torture. And later this year, in May or June, South Africa is going to be going back to the UN for the second round of the Universal Periodic Review, and it's going to be asked, why have you not criminalized torture? Why in 4 years since you appeared here the last time has it not occurred? And it's very important that we have the necessary legal framework so that we can actually deal with cases, so that people understand and know that torture is not tolerated and that it affects the sense from other clients, and it's also received that, that social outrage which it ought to, and that we say as a country it is not acceptable. I think a second thing which needs to be done, and something a lot closer to this committee, is that there are mechanisms by which you can prevent torture. And going back to what I said in the beginning, there is no country on the planet which is torture-free. Torture will happen. It's what the state does about it, and what the state does about it to ensure that it is prevented. Torture is one of those things where all of us have to remain constantly vigilant. We cannot rest. And even if there's one incident of torture, that is one too much. And I think, yes, there is work that has been done in South Africa. It's around the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture. In terms of the optional protocol which South Africa signed in 2007, our next step is that we need to ratify. But if we ratify and we then implement it, South Africa will set up a national preventative mechanism. And the national preventative mechanism is a system of visits to all cases where persons are deprived of their liberty, not just prisons, jail cells, psychiatric hospitals, places where persons with intellectual disabilities live, any place where a person is deprived of their liberty. And in terms of a system of regular visits, it has been found internationally that this is the way to go to prevent torture. It is not something that goes back again to what the chairperson said in introductory comments. A preventative mechanism is about finding solutions. It is about improving conditions. It is not about an antagonistic individual complaint system. It's a system of visits where people go in, they have access to all necessary places within the detention facility, they can speak to all inmates and residents, they then need to write up, they then engage with the authorities, they write up a report. And the aim is to improve the conditions. It doesn't go just to torture, it goes to the conditions in which people are kept. And that again goes to the chair's comments that were made earlier. So I think certainly, yes, there is the Makali matter, which is now before us, as a country, as all of us who have different roles to play. We all need to play that role. The Commission ensuring that the Mexican Power Act is done, and to continue to bring Parliament, relevant ministers, relevant bodies involved, to see that in terms of our international obligations, South Africa does respond. But I think also at a more broader level, McCallum provides us with an opportunity to say maybe we just need to sit back for a moment and say, what is going on in our prisons? Are we creating the kind of conditions in our prisons where persons will be rehabilitated, where they will be able to reintegrate into community? When people are sentenced to prison, they are sentenced, that is the punishment. Additional things of beatings, etc., are not part of the punishment. And I think on that note, I've used up my time, and I'd like to thank you very much, and we are just all 10 games in service of the committee.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Let's go to the helpful comments, criticism, emphasis, Mr. Mark Abdullah, and then Mr. Shah, and then Mark Renia.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. I thank you to the people that I didn't get the I thank you very much for presenting very well. I will get you. no matter, I didn't get you where you from. I know that you are from South Africa, human rights, but as you said, South Africa has been called to prevent the disability in South Africa. They've been called and the disability are everything the same. We as South Africa, we called and we didn't respond. But you take it if you are from the other country. For that, I take note as you think. And second, South Africa is a very good country in terms of the constitution. You are having a constitution with you here. It's very clear. We don't want to torture South Africa. And then we also speak about the human rights. All right in South Africa, right to even the right of privacy, no matter what the inmates and the officials that are working with the inmates. But it's a problem, some of the things, because in terms of the right, we don't, the inmate is having a right as a human being, is having a right also of the privacy. It makes also a problem, not it gives us a problem to not put any systems that will look at what the inmate is doing at night, because they are having a right of privacy. And then we don't know what they are doing there. And in the end of the day, the torture that you are speaking with is okay at the end of the day, but we were supposed to prevent it through the human right, but we can't because of this right and right and right. Yes, South Africa is a bad country, according to you. The only thing is that they didn't just respond when the United Nations called. But it's a very old country. Look at our constitution. It reflects everything in terms of the human rights. And then also, this parliament didn't refuse. If anyone wants to come with the torture, bill, so that you know that if there is a torture, this is the sentence, this is what you must do. This parliament didn't refuse that. If anything is having an idea, you can just make an appointment to come to the committee and present it. If you present it, really, we can't refuse, deny it, because some other things. Remember, this is the new democracy. We don't have even 25 years in the democracy. We still building our democracy so that it will be nice. You remember also that South Africa is the last country in Africa to get the independence. So some of the things we are building this country to be more good. And remember, and I can bet you, no matter South Africa is young in terms of their democracy, but sometimes it's far better than other things that are happening to the other countries which I won't speak about it. So I thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and to Kevin. I'd like to just deal with some specifics, if I may. It would seem to me that, judging from what you said, that there are really three things that need to happen. First, we need to legislate criminalize torture. Secondly, we need to prosecute those that are found guilty of it. And thirdly, we need a more efficient oversight mechanism. Now, that brings me to your comment around the Cullen matter, which you described as embarrassing, and I would agree with that description. And you said that we should work together to prevent that happening again. But what worries me about the Cullen matter very much like to hear from the traditional inspector whether they knew about it, what they did about it, whether the ICDs were chucked out while there was month-long lockdown. But I mean, I was on the portfolio. We felt by not taking notice, by not intervening, by not doing our stuff. The courts failed. The judges failed by not inspecting. The Human Rights Commission failed by not intervening. There was a collective failure by all the oversight mechanisms that we had in that particular instance. Now, if we find the optional protocol, we're going to create another one. Now, the point I'm simply making, and I'd like to comment on, is it not a question of increasing the effectiveness of the existing oversight structure, rather than create another oversight and another monitoring and preventive mechanism that's going to duplicate the roles that already exist, and that maybe if we do need to improve the oversight, what we need to do on a more regular basis, those amongst us, as previous presidents would have said, those amongst us who have the duty to undertake oversight tasks, maybe we should spend more time coordinating activities and sharing experiences so that we have a common knowledge of what is going on, so that the spotlight on what happens in the dark corners of our prisons becomes that much more transparent. Then to move on to the reasons for South Africa's failure to respond, which is troublesome, but I would be interested to know your views on why that was so, because presumably if South Africa had made an admission in this respect, it would have come with certain legal consequences of theft. And you mentioned that there are 300 civil claims pending in the Port Elizabeth High Court, and presumably if the state had made an admission of any sort whatsoever, that would have then been used as corroboration of that civil claim, thus preventing, or thus making the case more winnable. And I'd be interested in your views about the conflict that must exist between the capacity to be honest and open with an international institution of this nature, and at the same time protecting the rights, if you like, the limiting the liability of the state in dealing with these sorts of cases. Finally, if I could just ask you, you've referred to a number of other institutions in the written submission that you made, and amongst others, the Africa Peer Review Mechanism, the African Charter of Human and People's Rights, the Robben Island Guidelines, and all these good things. It seems we have volumes of guidelines, but no action. And can you give us some sort of idea of what the status of these other guidelines and what obligations South Africa does or does not fulfill in terms of those other international interests?
When the case of the master.
and the challenge that we are facing is that we can't see inside even the ones that are looking after the image in our center by that eye. It's so difficult for them to see what is happening. And now, the challenge that we are facing on your side as people who see human rights, we were trying to check that if maybe we can put a CCTV inside, so that we must see what is happening inside. Therefore, there's this thing that you are seeing of human rights change. That we know that once you do that, without getting your view or agreed with it, we're going to evaluate the rights of the inmate. And I believe that you can agree with me that really in ourselves, where the image are, there are challenges inside. You will find a painful experience. You find that the image has died by beating, by assault, and the person that has done that, they don't know who is suspect. And what they need to do, the image, they take the card of other image that they hate, or that image is made to be out, since that image cannot go out, and put it on top of the image, as if that person is the one that they kill them. Therefore, this camera is going to assist in terms of seeing that who has do what inside in the sense. I want to get from you that what is your view about those cameras in terms of the security of the image?
Thank you very much. Let's first start with what the last speaker spoke about, and just to review that. This committee is of the view that the prevention of torture, for instance, has to supersede your right to privacy in the staff that are a shared environment for all the reasons that you've raised and the reasons that have been raised by the members. And we have tested it against many institutions, you only one, not only one, but you one of the few, so we can't get from these. Because we strongly believe that we are going to move in that direction. We're going to move in that direction, and we expected our position, but up to now everybody is in the field, so we want to comment on that. Chancellor, so to indicate that, and members will correct me, when we passed the Correctional Matters Amendment Act, we did insist in that act that the legislation that you're talking about should be looked at and they should come back to the 6 months. But I am saying that from our side we are doing something about that, and we will certainly continue to monitor that from our side. I agree with Mr. South that I think that there are sufficient policies, it's about implementation. Even yourself, your role or the power that you have is to investigate and report. On this matter, you have the power to investigate and to report. And I also think that this is correct. All of us have a collective. So, all of us need to own up in terms of what it is that we are. And I'm suggesting that this committee is actively saying that we're going to move for better surveillance. And one of those better surveillance is our cameras, and we fight that fight as far as we're going to take that fight. Could you indicate to us, if you did investigate, or if you did not investigate, why didn't you, or what was it blocking you? From our side, we also make an undertaking that we interact with our colleagues in justice and make sure that this case is later and receive the attention that it needs to receive. So, I said I just put that context so that when you respond, at least you understand something that we have or something that we propose, and we're asking for that to respond to that.
Thank you. I think, as the chair correctly pointed it out, is there have been numerous systems of failure in this matter. To speak from the side of the South African Human Rights Commission, I can share with the committee how we found out about the Makhani matter. Within the international program, we put together a report each year on what has been happening at the international level. And it was in putting this report together that we found the Makhani matter. So it was post the fact. It was the decision was made on the 25th of October, and we found out about the Makhani matter in about February, March this year. And I think for us as a Human Rights Commission, it has raised a number of issues which we also reflect on. It raises also issues around the international system and how it works, and how there's no mechanism at the international level for us also to be notified around this matter. We have subsequently interacted with McCallum's lawyer. At no stage did he approach the Human Rights Commission. And I suppose that can also raise issues for us to reflect on why did he not approach us. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned in terms of this matter and for us to see where it's gone. And we were zooming in on the issue around CCTV cameras, because I know that this is an issue which this committee has been grappling with for a long time. It's one of those things where, as the committee, when you ask, it's like, is there a yes or a no answer? And unfortunately, one's going to give a typical legal answer and say, it depends. I don't think it's the kind of thing where you can just give a straightforward yes or no. We all know that in terms of the Constitution, there is a limitations clause. And we all know the current conditions in our prisons. We know the types of incidents of violence that occur, particularly at night time, when the prisoners are put into their cells. So the issue of CCTV cameras, I think this committee should be encouraged to look at the issue, tease out the issue, because it's going to come down to an issue of the manner in which it is done, where these cameras are placed, at what time they are on, what would be the degree of the violation. So it's going to go directly to the kind of implementation which this committee is envisioning. And I think that the committee is going to have to work very closely with state law advisors. You may certainly approach the Human Rights Commission. I'm sure there are, unfortunately, in Minnesota, we have many experts in the field, academics, which can join in. Because one thing which everyone is united about is that we would like to see less violence happening in our prisons. We would like to see that we have prisons where there is no gang activity. So the question is more, how do we get to that point? So unfortunately, I'm not giving a straightforward yes, no, but I'm certainly encouraging this committee to engage further, and we can certainly engage with you. And it is only going through all the steps and exactly what is envisioned that we can come to a final conclusion on the matter. And having said that, even if the if this committee decides to go that route and the decision is taken, it may still end up being challenged. But sometimes this is what you need to do. In terms of some of the other questions that were raised, there was also the issue specifically is, will the OCCAT lead to just another institution, a mushrooming of institutions in South Africa? And I think at the Human Rights Commission, we are acutely aware that we are a country with limited resources. We don't have endless resources. We already have a number of oversight structures. The OCCAT, however, does not specify what it is that the oversight mechanism, the preventative mechanism, might look like. It is up for each country to determine for themselves. And as a commission, we are aware we've been working for a number of years around the OCCAT. Last year in September, we had a very successful meeting with a number of government departments who know that they are considering the OCCAT and how to implement it. There's serious work going on, as we said here now. And that is where this committee can come in to give that push, to just keep that work going. And some of the options that have been considered in some of the other African countries is to take existing mechanisms and maybe join together a number of existing mechanisms. But we do, for example, have the Traditional Inspector for Correctional Services, which has their RPDs. There is already a whole structure up there. The thing, though, is currently the manner in which the Judicial Inspector works. It works on a reactive basis, so it reacts to complaints. Whereas the preventative mechanism, which has been demonstrated does effectively prevent torture, is that the visits need to be preventive in nature. So it is, the question would be, do you keep both types of visits, or do you swap over to preventive mechanisms? Or do you have both types of visits occurring, that some visits are reactive, taking complaints, and others are preventive in nature? And these are some of the debates on the departmental level, which is being grappled with. And there is work, and they are thinking about what it is that can be put forth. I think in terms of South Africa being a good country with a human rights track record, yes, that is correct. And in relation to many other African countries, we are held in extremely high regard. And I think that, though, however, puts even more pressure on us as South Africa. When one travels at an international level, when you attend things such as 2 weeks ago in Geneva, such as the OCCAT Global Forum, there is an expectation which is articulated to you as a South African. We are looking at you. We want you to take the lead to show us what it is that can be done in terms of torture. So the fact that we've already got this wonderful constitution, it creates expectations out there that we really will play a lead in torture prevention in Africa. And we all know that there is an enormous amount of work that needs to be done. In terms of a framework, we were being asked about that. There is the framework. I was also asked around how South Africa is doing at the African regional level. Again, similar to the international level, when it comes to the African Commission, we are behind on our reports. We don't at this stage have any individual complaints that we are aware of that has been left at the African Commission level. In terms of the Robben Island guidelines, which are regional mechanism giving effect and fleshing out, sort of bringing an African flavor to the optional protocol. There is at a regional level a committee which deals with the Roman Islands guidelines. But in terms of Africa, we do need to point out that the UPCAT is a relatively new instrument. It came into being in 2006. South Africa, by the way, was very involved in this dancing at the UN level. I think it's something that we can all be proud about. But on the African continent, even though a number of countries have signed and some have even ratified the optional protocol, there are, if I recall correctly, four countries which have currently established national preventive mechanisms. And I know I've got a man from the ABT, and perhaps shall correct me if I'm incorrect, but he's saying it's right. But there are four countries. So that's also which just demonstrates that internationally around the world, torture prevention is something which all countries are grappling with. And it's something that needs to be done. In relation to the issue of the conflict of the state to admit to what happened, I can see where you're coming from. Whether the state in a way has to try and prevent itself. We all know that correctional services each year when it tables its annual report, there's a rather large amount that's gone to legal fees. I don't know if it's come down. I know about 2 years ago it was sitting just under $1 billion, if I recall correctly. I don't know if that's come down in recent years. But the bottom line is, in terms of our obligations, there can be no impunity for torture. And therefore, in a sense, it would be more cost effective for the department and for the state to ensure that there are adequate preventative measures. So it'll be more cost effective than having to run up the costs of being sued. As to the reasons I think it was being suggested, is this why South Africa did not respond? I think that is something we as the Commission would be hoping when we get responses from the different government departments. We would hope that this committee joins us in terms of the oversight it exercises to really get to the bottom of why there was no response. Is this simply a case of possibly staff our office in Geneva receiving these letters and possibly not having been trained or just didn't get that this was serious and needed to be forwarded on? Was correctional services, did international relations ever forward this correspondence to correctional services? Or was correctional services like the Human Rights Commission after the fact, after South Africa had not responded five times, they suddenly called, you know, unaware, and then now the one sitting there today? I think these are really the things that we need to get to the bottom of. Pleasure. Have there any ones which I'm really hoping that it is our expert at the Commission that you will come in? I'm just trying to say, I've spoken quite a bit and I certainly have tried to address everything. I don't know if there's anything in particular so far. Thank you.
Thank you. We will come back to you. Thank you very much. I think it was important that we had a discussion around the medical plan or whatever you want to call it. I don't think anybody in this room is disputing whether they shouldn't be there. I don't think anybody such outlaws shouldn't be there. So appealing to members or to organizations that speak after this, maybe to focus on what it is that needs to be there. work and certain correctional services in the main, because that's where we have the most power as a commission. Should there be a change of work method between correctional services, 41,000 employees? Should it be looking at changing the environment or both? Should it be about training? I know in the committee we always talk about some of the tools of the trade that they have that sometimes we say they shouldn't have. That's the type of thing that I'm going to get us to debate, so that when we consider the budget next year, or when we can act with them, we must be able to answer your questions. Why do we need an electric shield, or why do you need whatever it is that we need, rather than talking around the legislative requirements. You know, I think on that one we're all in agreement. It's just about ensuring that we one, put it onto the statute book, and two, make sure that it is then implemented. So those that speak, and I'm sorry that I'm ambushing you, but if you could talk to us about what do you think we should do as a department, I mean as a committee, in terms of influencing the department, doing things differently, the end result being that torture is minimized. It probably would not be eradicated as you indicated, but minimized. So members of both of the ladies to make our life a little easier. Can I move on to the next one? Thank you very much. Could we then ask Association for the Prevention of Torture to take a position?
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Amanda Dissel. I'm from the Association for the Prevention of Torture. My position is called what is known as the Delegate in South Africa. A very strange title. The ABC is an international NGO which is committed to the eradication of torture throughout the world and as well as cruel and human degrading treatment of punishment. We've been a legal, the leading international organization in terms of promoting the adoption and implementation of the optional protocol and was very involved in the development of the protocol and seeing it through the whole process, through the UN process. ABC has been working with South Africa for over a decade, even in 2002 around the development and in the signing of the Robben Island Guidelines, the Association for the Prevention of Torture is very involved. But since 2005, we've been working with the South African Human Rights Commission, particularly on the ratification for them, the signature, signing, ratification, implementation of optional protocol. More recently, we've been working with an interdepartmental task team that has been set up by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. The task team consists of representatives from various government departments, including Mr. Mtetwa, who's sitting over there, and the representative of the Department of Correctional Services. Most recently, ABC has hosted an African regional workshop on OSCA, and this happened as Judith Cohen referred to 2 weeks ago, as well as a global forum on OSCA. And this was very well represented by South African delegates, including the Deputy Minister of Correctional Services, two staff members, and two members from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. So I think that is an indication that there is a high level of commitment to engaging with the optional protocol of OSCA, which I've had referred to, and to looking at measures to prevent torture. So we very much welcome this opportunity to present and to discuss these issues before the committee here today. I think before I go into what some of the practical suggestions, I think it's worthwhile reflecting on what the McCallum case does actually, what it does highlight. And I think we've already talked about these issues. The one is the failure of the South African government to cooperate with the hearing and the process. The second is that the claims made by McCallum were not investigated. Though he did approach various institutions, various bodies, and asked for investigation, asked for assistance, that fell through. There were violations in terms of the government's control and political rights. Violations of torture, including human degrading treatment. He was denied his remedies in terms of the Cummins as well. That was his remedies to criminal procedures, to investigation, to medical attention, and so on. And I think what is important is that the committee has called upon the state to fulfill obligation to provide at home with an effective remedy. So South Africa still has work to do on this instance, and they are busy with South Africa is busy with it. And I'm sorry for the honourable member, but here I'm talking about the government's role particularly. But South Africa has also been asked to look at ways to prevent torture in the future, also in the violations in the future. But the current matter also highlights again that torture and ill treatment is prevalent in correctional services and in South Africa. I think that we can rest assured that this is just one incident of many that haven't come to our attention. Also that this case was brought to the Human Rights Committee by one individual, but there were many, many other people affected. As is indicated by the court case that has been brought on behalf of 300 inmates that were involved in that particular incident. What I also just want to highlight is that when we look at the prevention of torture and ill treatment refers to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. We are not just talking about assault, we are not just talking about intentional positive acts or omissions by the correctional authorities. We are also talking about the physical conditions, treatment, and care that inmates receive in places of custody. And I just want to remind you that the former special rapporteur of torture has repeatedly brought attention to conditions in detention and police cells as being a violation of the Convention against Torture. Where he talks about the structural deprivation of most human rights, including the rights to food, water, clothing, healthcare, minimum of space, hygiene, privacy, and security needed to create a humane and dignified existence. Non-fulfillment of these existential rights amounts to a systematic practice of inhumane or degrading treatment or punishment. I think that's very important for us to look at as well, particularly when you look at the ongoing reports of the judicial inspectors and also of the community in your oversight of this, noting that the conditions of detention are frequently inhumane and a violation of human dignity and many of the other rights that are contained in the Constitution. But then moving on also to the special rapporteur is particularly concerned about remand detainees, because I think that often we spend a lot of time talking about sentenced inmates and perhaps not enough time reflecting on the conditions of remand detainees, which we know are often a lot worse than many others. Then just moving on to the obligations in terms of positive acts or remission, again, we know that from information that has come before the committee that there are a high number of faults that are reported to by the department. But these number of faults that are reported by the department as occurring in correctional services is less than half the number of faults that are reported to the judicial inspectorate. So again, there are a number of faults that are being reported or that are happening but are perhaps not even coming to the attention of the authorities. Or the inmates are afraid to make those reports of assault. And I think that's something that we need to look at. What is it about the environment that is making inmates afraid to report? Death in correctional services. Correctional services is obliged to report death to the inspecting judge who may carry out an inquiry or instruct the commissioner to carry out an inquiry. And I want to point out that the judicial inspector conducts very few inquiries. In fact, I'm not sure if it does, in fact, conduct any inquiries directly itself. And I think I'm going to highlight this when I come back to my recommendation in terms of the inquiry. So it generally receives a report from the correctional services and comments on that report. I'm not going to go into the number of deaths. I think that you all have that information already. Another potential area for omissions or positive violations of rights in relation to segregation and solitary confinement. Now, of course, solitary confinement is no longer a permissible punishment in South Africa, but the judicial inspector has noted that there are several instances where segregation has been used in violation of the Correctional Services Act requirements, where the judge has not been notified that people have been segregated, he has not been notified that the segregation has been extended, or that there has been any proper examination by a medical practitioner as required by the Act. Looking at measures to prevent and combat torture and your treatment, I just want to reflect on the current UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. This is the person who is responsible for conducting investigations, in-country investigations at an international level, and reporting back to the UN Committee on Human Rights. At the Global Forum on the 10th of November this year, Mr. Mendy noted that torture occurs not because national legal systems are ineffective. It persists because governments do not take action. It is entrenched because of the climate of non-enforcement and impunity. And I think that these are particular issues that we need to remind ourselves about how to prevent torture in the future. If we look at the convention, there are a number of requirements, including the state is obliged to take legislative, administrative, judicial, and other measures. So there's a whole range of measures that the state must take in order to prevent torture. And I think that also when we look at the convention, it is not just in terms of our international obligation or our obligation to the international community, but it's very much our obligation towards our national community, to the people who are victims or potential victims of torture and ill treatment. Once again, I think it's reflecting on the fact that the torture law has taken so long to see its passage through Parliament. We saw the first draft in 2003. We've been told on a number of occasions that it's going to be presented to Parliament this year, then we told it's next year, then we told again it's the following year. So possibly by the time it does come before Parliament, it will be 10 years in the making. And I think that is again the role of the committee to push that through, as the chairperson has already indicated. The convention requires that perpetrators of torture and treatment must be punished. And I'd like to point out that even though the convention talks about criminalizing torture, it doesn't mean that people cannot be punished in the interim until torture has been criminalized. They can still be prosecuted in terms of the existing criminal law. But the fact that that once torture is made a criminal offense, it certainly does carry an additional moral weight and authority for someone who has violated that. Article 10 calls upon states to ensure that education and information regarding the prohibition of torture is fully included in the training of law enforcement personnel. Now, I don't know in detail what the training curriculum of the correctional services does contain, but I'm pretty sure that there is some mention of the prohibition of torture. I would like to see that this be made much more explicit and that a more extensive training around torture and its prohibitions and how to prevent torture and your treatment is contained in training centers. It should, of course, not be just part of basic training, but also be part of ongoing and further training for correctional officials. There's a whole lot of administrative measures that the state could take to monitor the prevention of torture. I'm not going to go into detail of those. Article 12 requires the state to ensure the competent authorities conduct a prompt, impartial investigation whenever there are reasonable grounds to believe that act of torture has been committed. And I think this is where we're seeing that there's a huge lack. This is what has failed in the McCullough matter, and this is where I think that the judicial sector has not been taking perhaps a sufficient role in investigating allegations of torture. There is provision for a complainant to lodge a complaint with the police, but there are many instances where the police are not following through, or they find it difficult to conduct an investigation in prison. The judicial inspector has also said that in many cases where unlawful use of force by a correctional official has taken place, only 3 reports were made to the judicial inspectorate during 2009. So this also points to a failure of the correctional services to adhere to its main mandate to make reports of assault. The Article 16 also calls upon states to prevent cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment or punishment. And I think this is where you find the distinction between the obligation to prohibit and punish aquaculture and the obligation to prevent ill treatment. Just in terms of prevention, we've been talking about prevention through regular oversight, and this is something that I think the ABT really supports, and it's part of what has been learned internationally through best practice, that this is one of the mechanisms for preventing poultry and ill treatment, is to establish effective oversight mechanisms of places of detention. And this is what the optional protocol aims to do. It takes up two mechanisms. The one is the international mechanism, which is the special subcommittee for the prevention of torture, the ABT, and they conduct visits to state parties. But what is more important to our purposes is the national preventive mechanisms, or NPM, which must be established. A state must establish one or more of these mechanisms to conduct visits in places where people are deprived of liberty, in all places where people are deprived of their liberty. And as the poem noted, that these are need to be preventive, they put them about recommendations and proposals. Starbucks is a signatory, and as I mentioned, we also quite advanced in the process already. Now, we know that the judicial inspector already is an oversight mechanism in correctional services, and it does have the mandate to conduct regular visits to cases of detention, both by the judicial inspectors as well as by the ICCD. And it can also conduct inquiries into these in prison and assault and other issues that come to the attention of the judge. And I think these mechanisms have certainly added to the quality of oversight over correctional services, and I think that they probably, it's fair to say, that they have made an impact on conditions and treatment in custody over the years. But I think that we need to look at how to strengthen those particular mechanisms. One of the shortcomings the judicial inspector has noticed over the years is the lack of follow-up on the reports that it has made to the correctional services of the ministry. That it has made reports and it hasn't heard responses. The Correctional Services Amendment Act was amended so that the judicial inspector could make reports directly to this committee as well. But is this sufficient? Does this actually act as an effective monitoring mechanism, an effective monitoring tool? And is it done regularly enough? I think that we need to look at that. And we need to perhaps look at establishing a mechanism where the department is obliged to report on how far it has gone in terms of implementing the recommendations, and then the judicial inspector or the committee could engage with the department around that. And maybe a more regular mechanism for doing this needs to be established. The optional protocol also requires that state parties must publish reports of the national preventive mechanism. Again, we have the judicial inspectorate publishing its annual report. And from time to time, the judicial inspectorate publishes reports on thematic issues. So, if, for example, it conducted a study on conditions in certain kinds of prisons. It most recently, published a mini study on deaths and custodies. But we don't get what we don't get is reports on inspections to individual prisons, or we don't get reports on investigations or inquiries into particular matters. And I'd just like to refer the committee here to the reports of the prison ombudsman in the United Kingdom, which publishes a report on every single visit or every single investigation that it undertakes. And you can go to the website and you can find a 30-page report of an investigation into a death in custody for every single death that has occurred. I think that this is very important for making transparent what is happening in the correctional services. We don't see that the correctional services did everything it could to prevent the death. It is still important for the public, the victims, the victims' families, as well as the officials to know and to be able to reflect on what happens in that particular circumstance. I think I would like to reflect on a comment made by Mr. Jean-Marie Delarue, who is the controller of the French NPM the National Brain Mechanism in France. And this is one of the bodies that is internationally regarded as possibly one of the best examples of a national preventive mechanism. It was a body that was established specifically in terms of OCAT to conduct overtime for this. And he said he noted that it's important that overtime for this body shouldn't be reassured by what rights are contained in the law or by assurance that detainees are afforded certain rights and treatment. In other words, one mustn't just look at what the law says is in fact, but one must actually start questioning whether the right is actually exercised in practice, when, how often, and under what circumstances. And I think that, for me, is really quite a guiding note in terms of how one can go about conducting oversight for this. I've already spoken about the launching. The other issue I'd like to raise is the issue around thematic investigation. We have investigations that the judicial inspectors undertake from time to time with correctional services, and I've said those are not made public, and they might be, you know, I'm not particularly clear. But I think that it is important to undertake thematic investigations where you want to go into in-depth analysis into certain issues that are occurring. So, for example, gang violence in prison is an issue that has been an ongoing concern in correctional centres for years and years. That could be one particular inquiry. But there are also prisoners with particular needs. So, for example, a special investigation into the needs, treatment, and care of remand detainees, those who suffered worse conditions in treatment, mentally ill prisoners, aged and disabled prisoners, what are the conditions and treatment and care for them. These are often people who are particularly vulnerable to abuse from fellow inmates, as well as who suffer quite a lot from the conditions in prison. Foreigners, what about foreigners held in prison? I have a suspicion of having committed crime, as well as those who are convicted or awaiting repatriation. The other thing is that the OCAT provides for the National Preventive Mechanism to employ experts with required capacities and professional knowledge. So NPM members should have professional knowledge in relevant fields in which they're conducting their visits, such as human rights, healthcare, and administration of justice. Here, the judicial inspectorate does have the capacity to contract in consulting from time to time, but I'm not aware that the judicial inspectorate actually does that. It could very possibly be that its investigations, its inspections in prisons could be very much enhanced by the assistance of experts, for example, medical experts, penological experts, legal assistants, trainers, educators, all of those kinds of people could provide a lot more information and assistance to the judicial inspectors. And what, of course, the judicial inspectors have, one of its key functions is to make recommendations to the correctional services to improve conditions for the future. So in conclusion, I just like to note again that it would be important for South Africa to domesticate the Convention Against Torture by criminalising torture, but also by making sure that the bill contains provisions to enact the other aspects of the Convention, which I mentioned some of them, and I think we'll mention others. We would also recommend very strongly that South Africa ratify the optional protocol to the Convention. We do have existing mechanisms in some aspects of the Convention. We have the judicial inspectorate in respect of prisons, but most of the other facilities where people are deprived of their liberty, they do not have oversight mechanisms. And so we do need mechanisms over all phases of detention. It's also important that we learn from the lessons and the challenges of the judicial inspectorate in order to improve whatever mechanisms are put in place in the future. Then, thirdly, I think it's very important that when we're talking about torture prevention, we're talking about preventing impunity. And when we're talking about preventing impunity, we're talking about holding the state accountable. I've talked about the importance of investigation, allegations of torture and ill treatment, and the suggestion that this is not being thoroughly done to this point. It's important to build the capacity of whatever investigative body, and I think it would be important to have an external body like the judicial inspectorate or ombudsman which does come to conduct the investigation. It's important that the body publish it, that makes public the report of its investigations, the findings and the recommendations. Fourthly, it is important to monitor recommendations that are made by an investigative body, by an oversight body, by a decision maker as a private committee, and to monitor the reason how these recommendations are responded to and how they are being implemented. Again, it's important to publish these responses so that it's transparent for everybody to follow how they're being dealt with. And then I think that it's also important to discipline and punish the perpetrators of torture and mistreatment. This is important to hold individual perpetrators responsible. And here we can also look at, instead of, for example, the state being the only body which is held responsible and which pays out compensation or claims to victims, could one look at, for example, making individual perpetrators pay claims to victims as well? Thank you, Jessica.
This meeting, but we continue to be that when it comes to this torture is not only perpetrated by the state. Now, I'm raising that because I'm seeing contradictions coming out here. First of all, is there a line between torture and abuse? Is there a line or should there be a line between torture and abuse? I'm asking that because if you take the scenario in any of our facilities where the leader of the gang decides that this is going to be my wife. And sexually, you call it abuse, I call it rape, that person over whatever period. Is that torture or abuse? I'm asking the question in that context. Now, if that is torture, and the only way to deal with that is to take the abuser to a single cell, because as long as it's in a communal cell, it's going to duplicate virtue of the hierarchy in the gang. I heard somebody saying that solitary confinement is outlawed. So I'm saying we have all these real things. What do you do with that individual? What do you do with that individual? If we're saying that solitary confinement is outlawed, we know that by virtue of the hierarchy, nobody is going to touch him after lockdown, and he is on a continual basis facing somebody that he has not designated as his wife. The question that I'm asking you, Mr. Stella, and everybody else, is that abuse or is that torture? Because if that is torture, then I think that you will find that while state officials are guilty, you probably find that the vast majority of those guilty of torture, if this is classified as torture, would in fact be innocent. What do we then do with that now? So that is the question that I'm asking. It's a real thing that this committee deals with every day. It's simple to deal with the official getting fired or whatever the case might be. What do we do with the leader of a gang that, wherever you place him in South Africa, is recognized as a leader and will continue to do that if we're saying that solitary confinement is outlawed? I'm saying these are the type of hard questions that we need to ask each other and deal with them. But yeah, if there are any questions, let's raise them and you can respond to them. And this gentleman, if you must have assembly that asking the question, where do you draw the line? Let's start with the toilet with you on first, and then we'll take Advocate next second. Oh, bigger one, yeah.
The question following up from the point that you just raised, which was a thing that also occurred to me during the presentation, is the first question of when does torture become torture? Because not having had the benefit of the fight of this draft bill, does the living condition that you referred to, because I mean the living conditions don't even conform to Section 7 of the Correctional Services Act. And 2/3 of them does concern violence by inmates on the expect people to comply? Does it deal with non-compliance with the guidelines and use of mechanical restraints and segregation? Doesn't it deal with assault? Doesn't it deal with rape? I mean, I want to know, at what point do you go over a threshold? And what are the circumstances that make torture torture as opposed to other things?
Remember, these are not close to Ms. Bissell only. You give her the lead, but everybody else who feels that you want to contribute, please indicate that you'd like to contribute, but we will give you Ms. Bissell the first bite at the cherry. Let's take Ms. Bissell, then I've got Max, followed by Mark Boyle, and Salton Glass.
Well, thank you, President, and thank you for the presentation. I'll talk on the issue of criminalization of torture. Well, it's very hard in the capital if you look at the figures that are in paragraph 2, number 4, where it says that 3,756 complaints were made of assault by inmates on another inmate. And then it goes on to say 2,189 complaints of assault by members. That is a very big figure. If members are also involved in this torture that we are talking about. And I think that if you go to the annual report, you'll find that in page 1993, the report says that where it says bodily injury stroke assault, it says that 976 million. Paid by the department, that's the cost of care. And it means that those claims are coming out of the source. I think that question is very serious. We need a committee for you to speed up this process of making sure that this is coming alive. You can help us because the department is the new type.
We reported it as a battery contract. We were informed that the Superior Ethics of Criminal Proceedings were taken. And are you aware what the outcome is? What the report is, what is the outcome for this?
Thank you, Dr. Thank you for the presentation. The chair, as far as I understand this presentation, most of the questions here need to be answered by the department. Because some of the issues that are raised in this report is the issues that you are waiting for the response from the department in terms of the image that they die inside in the cell, which we don't understand who is the killer. Is it the member or the inmate? And it shows here that we've got a big challenge in terms of the inmates that are dying inside in our center that are not dying by natural but they are killed. We've got that challenge. But my question on the that is presenting this also is going to go to the similar that one in terms of the view that what is your view in terms of this CCTV? I want to make example about the oversight that we're having in sensors and we in terms of the image that are placed to report. And the inmate was waiting for the committee to come. And when he reports about his brother that he died in front of him, and in their report that a issue was not a reported in their report. Then it shows that there's a lot of things that you can't get an effect on it, because there's no one able to tell us the truth if the case that take time long and is not reported in our report, so that maybe we can see when this thing has been happened and it was reported to the police. There was nothing that was showing that. But when we go inside, checking the cell, checking the inmate, then we get this report from the inmate that I want to report to the police that my brother was arrested with me inside in the center, and my brother had been died in front of my eyes, killed by the member. And you'll be shocked to get a report that says the brother of Kaisa was not killed by the member, was killed by the inmate. Therefore now we don't know who is the one that is talking the truth. So this camera is going to assist all of us to know the truth. Maybe that's why these cases are failing. You never heard even one day that there's one member from the center that is arrested because of killing. Because killing is a crime. But you never seen, not even one trial wash away because you have washed. No one. But you get a report that tells you that this inmate was sentenced 10 years, but because of the crime that he made inside in the center, then the sentence has been extended. But what about the members that are working inside in the center? Therefore, Chair, I would like to consult with Umaga to say really we need to make this thing work and make an act, so that we can deal about culture effectively. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Three small things. Ms. Thistle referred to a high level of commitment by the state, by the government, to OCCAT and measures for any torture. But yes, OCCAT was signed in 1996, now maybe 2012. No action. There seems to be a disconnect between the willingness and the commitment to go and do the stuff and the actual action. And I'd like to find out why that is. What's the impediment? Secondly, I'm very interested in the appropriate skills to enable those staff to be more effective. And I just noticed that for myself when we had a whole call to inspect the medical facilities. We had Cindy Chikunga with us, she's a qualified nurse, and it's an awful amount of difference between doing an oversight with a qualified nurse as opposed to doing an oversight when you have a qualified peripheral hack. And it made a huge difference to the quality of the report. Now, that's referred in your document that I was actually referred to in an optional protocol against torture implementation manual. That's the footnote. Now, this one's where we should have a copy of it. Somebody's got a copy of it, we don't have a copy of it. Alright, and then finally, just in terms of the court business case, 300 litigants. My colleague referred to the annual report and the contingent liabilities from 4E expenses. I don't see that 300 people being part of the contingent liabilities yet, and I'd like them from the CESPA to take careful notes, please, because when the department comes, I want an explanation about why that's not part of the schedule. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We maybe start at the beginning to indicate that we are scheduled to meet the department on the very matter. The intention of today's meeting was to empower us so that we put these questions to the department in as far as where they can sort it out. So I think we should indicate that to the department. In fact, the next meeting that we're going to have, because that's on the timing problem, so maybe we should just come here next so that members are aware that we're going to follow it up. The second issue is also to indicate, I think some of you have spoken about reporting and so on. I think just to be fair, the High Court and the Constitutional Court do on a regular basis go to oversight and give us the report. That's what Cameron and those people actually do that. I think the problem is the ability or lack thereof to take corrective measures on what has been observed. But they do, we should indicate to you that something does get done. It does come to us as Correctional Services Portfolio Committee, as CC after it's been sent to the Minister. I think we just need to tighten up what now? After it's come to us, what now? So we do get that on a regular basis. But this kind of thing, Mr. Sir, and anybody else to address the questions and statements made by Mayor Dionne or something. Okay, we'll allow you and then you hand it over to Mr. Sir and anybody else.
Our expert at our expert in the presentation would have defined for us what a crime constitutes torture, so that we are able to distinguish between acts of torture and ordinary assault. So that we don't just take any assault and that is a torture, or any death in prison and that is a torture. Fortunately, I went to reading Mr. Mountain's document. There is a definition given on torture and indicates that there should be four conditions required for an act to qualify as torture, including the act must result in severe mental and or physical suffering. It must be inflicted intentionally. It must be committed by or with the consent or assistance of a public official, which includes that the state official should, if the state official omits or fails to do something that could have prevented the infliction of severe mental physical suffering being inflicted upon another person by a non-state official. And the last condition is that it includes or it excludes pain and suffering as a result of lawful action. So one would then be able to confine him or herself in terms of acts of torture within those four basic conditions, that it should also be committed by or with the consent of a public official. But I've explained that Mr. Mountain would deliver it more on those, So I just wanted to say that when dealing with culture, we should be able to draw a line between what, because we don't want to get out of this meeting with the belief that any kind of assault in prison is culture, or any kind of death in prison is culture.
Mr.
Sir,
and everybody else? Yes?
I think the definition of torture is quite key, and obviously the first place to start is to adopt the definition that is set out in the convention, because I think the international jurisprudence really takes that convention as a starting point. And I think the second point to note is that there are many, many international cases which have deliberated exactly on what torture means and what ill treatment means and how to find the brain case. And I'm not going to go into that in a lot of detail. Hopefully Mr. Monty will go into it. But you're right, it's not that every instance where somebody is being hit with a baton that constitutes torture, but it certainly must constitute ill treatment. And I think also we should take note of, so generally the more serious, kind of assault or abuses that take place are torture, and generally the less serious assault or conditions which constitutes ill treatment. But that's a very, very broad definition, and I don't think that even meaning the UN Convention Against the UN Committee Against Torture will consider that important. Even the UN Committee Against Torture say that it's not so important to distinguish between torture and ill treatment, particularly when we're looking at prevention. We need to prevent torture and ill treatment. When we're talking about criminalization, then of course the definition distinction becomes much more acute. But one should also notice that, my colleague here has just noticed that there's a case that is coming before the courts now, which will look at the definition of torture. And I think it will be the first time that South African courts have really had to define what is torture. They've discussed many cases where allegations of torture have been made, but they haven't had to really grapple with the definition or the definition of ill treatment or calling him a very treatment professional. So this is a jurisprudence which I think we can look forward to being developed over time. The one issue I just wanted to note too is whether the torture can constitute act or omission. So a positive act would be, for instance, the McCullum matter where people were physically tortured, they were humiliated and degraded over a long period of time. That is a positive action. The failure to provide someone with medical attention when they have got a severe injury or illness, that could also constitute ill treatment or torture, depending on the circumstances again. The failure to protect people against gang violence or violence in prison or sexual violence in prison when the authorities know that sexual violence or gang violence or a particular victim is likely to be become a victim of that violence can also constitute torture by the state as well. So the state has obligations to prevent torture in that particular respect as well. So your question of CCTV cameras obviously has a lot of relevance here. The issue of whether the prisoner who assaults another prisoner or gang rapes another prisoner can himself be held liable for torture also depends very much on the definition. And I think there's been some debate, certainly in civil society, about whether the definition of torture should be expanded to include non-state actors as well. Currently, there is some discussion about this in the international community as well, about whether the definition refers only to state actors or whether non-state actors acting on their own authority. Obviously, we're a correctional official, as we know, the Jolly Commission, in that one prison where officials were implicated in prostituting inmates. That would be a case where an official is directly involved. But where a non-state actor is acting completely on their own, as we know, a number of gangs do a lot of times, whether that would constitute torture, I think it's something that's really up for debate as well. How much of the CCD?
Before the project, so that we understand it, as we're speaking here, we're talking about torture. Our understanding is torture can only be first perpetrated by state officials. That's our general understanding here. How do you understand now?
By state officials or someone acting under the authority of the
government.
Then in terms of the CCTV and whether that would be an appropriate mechanism to prevent abuses in cells, I think that it's really important for us to have a broader discussion on what would be the most effective mechanism or system to manage violence and attacking in prison. I think, for example, I just think of a prison cell in Johannesburg, Medium A, which has got 70 inmates in it. One cannot see from one end of the cell to the other cell. I don't think, for example, in that circumstance that a CCTV camera would make any difference at all. I'm not sure that it would be able to see anything, or that people could easily obscure their actions in that kind of circumstance. So I think we need to look at also what are the conditions in that particular cell or in that particular prison which are facilitating violence at a particular moment in time. Overcrowding is certainly one factor that needs to be considered. Another is possibly the lack of segregation of inmates, different categories of inmates. Another might be failure to have disciplined somebody in a prison cell who's been known to be engaged in violence beforehand. So there's a whole range of other remedies that I think that we need to look at as well before we assume that CCTV cameras is the only resource. And I'm not saying that it's the wrong response at all, but I'm just saying that I'm not sure that it's going to be the most effective. And certainly, I think that it's not going to be effective if cases are not brought to the attention of the authorities, if the authorities do not go back to their CCTV cameras and look at what is on the tape, or if somebody does not investigate the allegations. Whatever is recorded on a CCTV camera is going to be worthless. I think it's also very important to note that you mentioned this issue about an email reporting that we started with your client officials. I think it's important to note that investigation of torture or investigation of allegations in prisons is a very, very difficult endeavor. And it does require a particular level of skill and endurance, really, because there are so many motivating factors why people don't want to cooperate with an investigation. They are a fear of the knife from other inmates, from correctional officials. They have incentives not to cooperate with investigations. So we need to look at the building capacity for an investigative body that does conduct investigations. And in the sense, maybe, you know, to have the police coming in as an outside body and leave it going away is not the most appropriate mechanism. In terms of the outcome of the McCullum matter and whether there was an outcome of the investigation, I think I mentioned that as far as I know, there were disciplinary proceedings in place. I don't know if it's maybe the correctional services will be able to answer that question. In terms of a high level commitment, I think I've talked about a commitment at a high level. Which I think there's certainly a verbal commitment. There are certainly measures or certain activities that have taken place that are starting the process of both occupation and the domestic case of torture. And I think there must be various issues that are hindering the development of the process. Perhaps it's an issue of capacity in the Department of Justice. Perhaps it's to do with the lack of consultation or not receiving timely consultation or feedback from the other departments. I think that there's possibly a whole range of issues about what's affecting the delay. Certainly we have a copy, Mr. Smith has a copy of the OSCAP manual. It is available on our website, but I will certainly send you a copy if you give me your details and to any of the other community members who are interested. The other thing is, I think it's just that you mentioned that household judges and judges of Supreme Court are visiting prisons, and I think that's obviously a practice that should continue to be encouraged. I don't think that even if we have an NCM, it means that other bodies can't do it. Certainly that should be encouraged. But I do think that there's a certain amount of technical visitation that needs to take place, which I think probably judges, prosecutors and other individuals or bodies don't have the skill or the time to do. So for instance, the suggestion that you need experts to conduct a detailed inquiry or can provide information on a particular issue is very important. I can tell you
thank
you.
Yeah, we have to leave it. I'm not going to leave it. You come back there. The point that you make about CCTV cameras are going to be much out in the open carbon place. I think we're not just looking at it from an investigative or a post. We're looking at it also from a protest. If you know that somebody is monitoring you, chances are you will think twice before you're doing it. So I'm not going to be beaten on the phone of CCTV cameras. I can tell you that now. I'm not going to be beaten on it. I'm not convinced that your argument is old water. Mr. Mundi.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I do want to speak about the CCTV cameras. If we ask the question, how do we make our prisoners safer? The question originally arose from inter-prisoner violence, which is one of the research that has been done on this topic has not found that CCTV cameras reduce prisoner violence. This is what it is for. What has been shown to reduce levels of prisoner violence substantially companies and prisoners have access to a broad range of rehabilitation, education, and training programs to keep them busy. This places their anger and aggression. Before we jump to any solutions, I think we need to assess the possibilities of a broad range of issues and ask the question, what are all the things that we possibly can do to make prisoners safer? Yes, we may end up saying, you know, in certain situations, PPTV may be good when we want to do suicide watch, for example, and then one application. But I think we need to look at the broad range of issues when we end up. Thank you.
All right, I'm just worried that you've got an hour and you've got three presentations. For those of you presentations, so that at least you have the benefit of everybody, maybe we'll have to get you all to present and then we have one batch of it later on. I don't know, but just allow you, Mr. Max, to give it.
I just
want
to suggest to we were not too eager to sound so disagreeable about, or they were doubt about the CCTV cable. My view is that the CCTV was a set occasion from your officials, that there's something going on in there. But I think, yes, from you, I think it won't be actually inappropriate to request them to come forward with the proposal.
I feel just us
getting
and raising the opportunity. All right. Now, we certainly will come to you and ask you for proposals and those type of things, because it's all about finance and so on. We know that the presentation is not going to take place under the current circumstances. So to say that we must do the presentation, I think it's something that we would like, but we know when there's a facility that is housing 300 people and it should be housing 100 people, everything in the world we do will not be allowed in rehabilitation. We know that. So the question is, we must now begin to think more radical and broader than that. We have an overcrowded situation. No rehabilitation can take place under those circumstances. We can't rehabilitate me Monday morning at 8 o'clock to 4, and when I go into the cell at 6 o'clock, I'm being late. What rehabilitation is taking place here? So I'm saying, I'm just pushing the answer a little bit more. You can't rehabilitate me in the morning and I can rest in the evening. It doesn't work. It doesn't work under whatever circumstances. And I'm saying that South Africans, 70 years of democracy, we must think about making good. Even if it means it's difficult and it's not going to be comfortable, but we have to think about something good because we're not being told more prisoners to deal with this thing. We know that. So I'm just saying this is how the mechanisms are feeling. But we will welcome your discussion. This committee is always going to allow you to come and give us solutions to our challenges in overcrowding in our facilities. Ma'am, are you the next speaker, or do you want to deal with some of the questions that we have here? Yes, ma'am.
If overcrowding is one of the fundamental problems, and everything that's the violence that happens in itself is a result of that, can and state officials are responsible for overcrowding. Can that be regarded as torture?
So there's a question because you're right, because overcrowding is a function of the entire criminal justice system. It's not correct for services. So that is why we must have a discussion. I think you're correct, man. Which official then takes the blame? The judge that doesn't give out the sentences? The police that keeps me in there because it's taking too long to do the investigation? Who? So I think that's the question that needs to be asked. Yes, sir?
No.
Oh, you asked the
question?
No, I asked the question. No, the experts were asking it. Who wants to take the bite of it?
I I think that certainly the Committee Against Torture raises the issue of overcrowding and conditions in prisons with almost every country which has a problem with these conditions and calls upon states to take steps to reduce overcrowding. And that is a state responsibility that crosses across different sectors. It's the courts, the police, the correctional services. So there is a broad responsibility on the state to prevent overcrowding. I don't think that in all circumstances an individual correctional official who put one inmate into a cell of 70 inmates would be held liable for torture. But there might be certain circumstances where it could happen. You know, where, for example, somebody knows that particular incident is going to result in cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or torture to that particular individual. They know that particular individual is likely to get raped, and they haven't taken steps to prevent it. So there are circumstances, I think, where an individual or a group of individuals could be held responsible. I don't know if you're not.
Quite important to mention that the UN Special Rapporteur on torture
has looked into the trade and the electrical equipment and has called on states, and I quote, to designate and prohibit the manufacture, transfer, and use of certain forms of equipment specifically designed for or which have no or virtually no practical use other than for the purpose of torture or whose use is inherently cruel, inhuman, or degrading. And that's quite important to note for some of the equipment. And within South Africa, there have been some incidences in the use of this equipment, and the McCullum case has been widely mentioned in this hearing. And it was some of this electroshock equipment was used during the McCullum incident in the McCullum case. But there have been a number of other instances where there have been complaints from inmates about the use of this equipment by warders or correctional services staff against them, and there have been some investigations. They've even been homicides as a result of this equipment, either directly or indirectly being responsible for it. Three types of equipment that I just want to look at is the first one is the stun belt or shock belt, which is a device which is typically placed around an individual's waist, which has a device attached to it which can emit a particular charge. And the charges do range in terms of the equipment that's out there, but typically it's about 50,000 volts. And it's sometimes even the equipment is attached to the wrist and to the ankles of the individual, but typically it's around the waist. And then the kind of problematic aspect of this particular device is that it can be reused multiple times. For example, there's a locally produced product that on one particular charge can be used 900 times or 2 hours of continuous shock. And we don't know, there hasn't been sufficient medical studies in terms of the consequences of using these particular devices. You know, if a person is fairly healthy, there may be no permanent physical damage to the person, but there has been instances of seizures, of heartbeat irregularities, and psychological trauma as a result of using these devices. If a person is suffering from ill health, that can actually result in injury and death. The kind of key issue here is that often when devices are used, the person uses control of their body functions, so they often defecate and urinate, and often lose consciousness as well. And some of these belts have been prone to sort of accidental discharge. These belts are operated by a remote device, so you know, sometimes the remote devices sort of become faulty or they're being used inappropriately. It's important to note that the United Nations Committee Against Torture has recommended that the use of these stun belts should be abolished. The Council of Europe Committee for the Prevention of Torture classified these belts essentially as torture devices because you know you can use other means of restraint than using an electroshock approach as this particular equipment has. There have also been many international campaigns against this particular electroshock equipment. And the United States is not the only government that does actively use it, even though they are used in South Africa as well. Just to quickly mention the other types of electroshock equipment, the stun riot shield, which was used in the McCallum case, and also the stun baton. And the riot shields have, they're a normal riot shield, but they have conductive material, typically metal around the outside. With a device on the inside of the shield which will activate the charge, typically used in riot control situations, in prison scenarios as well, but have been used in a number of countries to allegedly engage in torture. The stun batons were really glorified cattle prods, electric cattle prods, and have been used in prison environments as well. Also, in terms of the shock that's given up, it does vary. Some of the batons that are out there can deliver up to 100,000 volt shock, which can result in quite significant injury. And so just on the recommendation on those three items of equipment is kind of a simple recommendation from sort of an advocacy activist point of view is that so I think government should actually consider abolishing using both stun belts, stun batons and stun shields and opt for other types of equipment that's not
final comments on mechanical restraint, particularly chains and leg irons. Just comments on what the UN minimum rules on the treatment of prisoners that states that chains and irons shall not be used as restraints. Also in the Namibian Supreme Court, the ruling of that court said that placing a prisoner in leg irons and chains constitutes degrading and humiliating treatment. So this is not as serious as the use of electroshock equipment, but and by essentially leg irons and restraints are directly involved in torture that can contribute to torture. And so kind of the recommendation of my colleagues is also that there should be some consideration on the prohibition on the use of leg irons and chains by in correctional centers. So I'd like to thank you very much for your attention and I welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, that was very interesting. Ban electric devices, ban leg irons. What is the committee saying? Questions of clarity, disputes, anybody else as well? I also have my views on that. I look at Max and then South and then Quinn.
Yeah, I just want to ask, what do you propose to replace it? We don't understand, you know, everybody got the right, no right actually. And you are sitting in that environment. It's a very ugly environment. There's not a lot of your citizens in there. Then you sit on the other end with the safety of your officials. Being a policeman for 37 years, I know what these people are even capable of doing. And you have to protect yourself and executing your mandate by the continuous use without any legitimate reason may constitute abuse. But if it is to execute a particular objective or to reach it within the legal framework, I can't really see, but the view thereof might constitute torture. So if we call to replace this, which I would agree is abuse thereof will constitute torture, what are you recommending should be used in this circumstance?
Sure, I'm very
glad
to
cover
by my colleagues, but the point I would simply make is this. If you take something like Ananias Marte, for example, who's a sort of serial tape artist, he managed to smuggle all sorts of stuff and escape twice, as far as I know. In what other circumstances, what else can be used that is the force within the parameters of decency and international best practice that can prevent somebody as dangerous as him from escaping? And surely the answer lies not in the devices themselves, but the protocols around the use of those devices.
Thanks, sir. Mine is not a question, just a comment on the very same issue of number by the official. The issue is really of the one and I think it is now very, very interesting that we push for developing. Because if these people come to class, it means that there's a problem in our system of recruiting as the existence is there. And also to check our curriculum, which is in line with what is happening since 1994.
Just a comment, I think I've been covered, I'll ask the same question. So just a comment. Central comment. When all of you prepared your presentation, or even for that matter, when this document was prepared, I'm just wondering, was it prepared in an ideal world, or did it take into account circumstances like South Africa where we have chronic overcrowding? I mean, maybe some place where the population, prison population, versus the official rate, it's not fair. Maybe these things are ideal. I'm asking specifically if you're looking at, for instance, the restraints. You have one official taking three members to barrack, one is offering the answer. You can't do otherwise. That's just the reality on the ground. Now, short of having them somehow restrained, it's not possible for one official to be able to do this. And
That is why I'm asking the question, when we make these recommendations, are we making them taking the material of the current circumstances into consideration, or at least just manage to have? Because I don't think we're going to get in a situation in South Africa shortly where we have the actual situation. So specifically, I don't have a problem with the electronic banning, but specifically around the other mechanisms, I think for self and master asking are very relevant in South Africa. Thank you. You can take the first part, and again, everybody else to take the rest.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members, for your questions and comments. I'm just on the electro shock type equipment. The recommendation is there are alternatives out there that don't use electro shock. I mean, particularly electro shock valves are problematic because you don't really need to use them only in exceptional circumstances with very dangerous criminals that have a history of escaping. But usually they escape because of other problems, not necessarily due to the particular restraint that's holding them in place. The same with the shields and the buttons, you know, sort of the shield, you can use the same shield without the electrical shock, can have the same effect in terms of you can restrain a person with a shield if you need to do that, but do you actually need to run an electric shock through them? The same with the buttons. On the issue of manacles and chains, I mean, obviously that is a very good question about the practicality thereof, and obviously in an ideal world would one not want that. But the response to the question of kind of capacity is maybe we need to address the capacity problem as well. There are ways of restraining prisoners. I'm not an expert in the field, but I'm potentially reporting on behalf of colleagues here. But there are alternatives out there that don't require the use of chains or lead lines in terms of transporting multiple prisoners. But I do agree that there's this kind of process where one should maybe work towards saving out a particular person.
Thank you very much, Chair. I want to express my sincere appreciation to the committee for creating this opportunity to discuss the crime of torture. My recollection is that this is the first time that the Committee of Parliament is actually discussing torture. Many of us have been talking about this for several years, so thank you very much for that. I'll try to be brief, not go through the whole submission. I want to say something about the status of the trial of torture, because I think that it is important to link to our understanding of torture and the problems we get to it. I'll speak briefly about the scope of the problem. Other speakers have also raised this. And then deal with some of the specific articles, and lastly, a couple of recommendations. I'll start with paragraph 3. According to international law, the prohibition of torture has an enhanced status of prevention norm of general international law. This means that it enjoys a higher rank in international hierarchy than treaty law or even ordinary customary rules. The important consequence of this is that because it is a peremptory norm, there is no reason why the state can derogate from it. There is no justification for it at any stage to say, yes, we can do this because of particular circumstances. So, because of the absolute prohibition of torture, no state is permitted to excuse itself from the application of the peremptory norm. Therefore, applies regardless of the status of the victim and the circumstances, whether they be a state of war, siege, emergency, or whatever. We cannot torture somebody because it is in a state of emergency. And it is very clear on this that when you talk about criminalizing torture, it gives the necessary common status to this, and that we, from civil society and from Parliament, communicate that message very clearly to officials taking care of people who provide services. Briefly on the scope of the problem, on page 3, paragraph 7, there is fortunately more information available now in the public domain than what there was a few years ago, and I think we are grateful to the inspectorate for the detailed description of unnatural death capacity. There's some table of that. I just want to highlight a few things at the bottom of page 6 that one can glean from these unnatural deaths that were reported. They were, by and large, the result of aggravated assault inflicted either as punishment or in retaliation by officials on prisoners. It also appears that these assaults were committed by groups of officials, so not individuals. It includes like in the Arden's case, but also in Creole, where they gang up on prisoners and beat them up. In a number of cases, the inspectors noted that the assault continued well after the prisoner was subdued and or the situation stabilized. This type of action goes well beyond what the law prescribes in terms of the minimum support. The most common weapon used, a baton, the prisoners were also subjected to chemical gas, electroshock equipment. In a number of cases, the deceased was denied prompt medical attention, even though the correctional services acted very clearly that the force was used, the prisoner must undergo a medical examination. It's also found that when disciplinary action is taken against officials, this takes extremely long to finalize. And from the data that the inspector submitted in his published annual report last year, not a single criminal prosecution has resulted. People have died in prison at the hands, respectively, of officials, and nobody has been prosecuted. In this infirmity, the sanctions imposed on governmental officials are extremely light, in my view. Of 16 cases listed, there is only one dismissal, and then officials receive 1 month without that. I don't think it's proportional to the death of an individual. Then on assault, on page 8, there's a graph that indicates the per 10,000 ratio, and we see that this fluctuates over time. It was 120 per 10,000 for 3 years running, and then it dropped to 60, and it increased again to 83 assaults per 10,000 prisoners. I think what it tells us is that we need to keep an eye on the situation. We need to monitor it continuously and ask questions from the department about what it is they are doing to reduce the number of assaults they incur. The submission deals with a number of specific incidents. We dealt with the McCullen case, the Alvin case as is known. There's also the Creosol case, and most recently, in July this year, at the Florida Central, there's an allegation of electroshock equipment again being used. So I would support my colleagues from the United States saying that actually that we need to really be far stronger than what we have been now. The submission then deals with Article 1 and 16. Article 1 of the UN Convention on Culture is the mission of culture, and that the committee research has already presented on behalf of CCRI. So I'm not going to deal with that in detail. I just want to reflect at the bottom of page 12. The third requirement in the definition that it must be committed by or with the consent or acquiescence of the public official. The important thing here is, as Mr. Sir has also alluded to, that if an official knows there is a reasonable risk that harm may come to another prisoner and he ignores that risk, that official is responsible. The state becomes responsible. The official cannot stand deliberately indifferent to the potential risk that exists. So, if an official places a first-time, permanent-looking prisoner in a cell with a bunch of armed gangsters, he knows that he's a risk that that person will get. On page 14, Article 10 of the Convention, the this revision would be included in the rules and instructions issued to all officials. My own experience, and Mr. Mteko can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the department does not pay much attention to the Convention Against Torture in Australia. Sorry about being surprised. I'm sure that personnel working with people required that their liberty are properly taken on a continuous basis, that communicate clearly what is expected and what will not be tolerated as required, enable officials to deal with potential problems proactively, and we should not underestimate the value of these training. In the end, it is more important that we prevent active torture. Article 11 of the Convention deals with the systematic review of interrogation rules, instructions, methods, practices, and so on. It means the base on the evidence collected by institutions such as the inspectors, the departments must go back to the drawing board and say, how can we improve our operating procedures? How can we improve our laws? And so forth. To my knowledge, the South African Police is the only government department at the moment that has a policy on the prevention of torture and good treatment of the Department of Correctional Services that does not have such a policy. Article 12 and 13 of the Convention deals with the prompt and impartial investigation of allegations of torture, and also that individual allegedly has been subject to torture in any territory has the right to complain to and have his case promptly and impartially examined by competent authorities. And I think the McCallum's case has illustrated how we collectively failed, as Mr. Starr pointed out, by investigating the matter sooner. So, I think what we can say about this is that there should be far more clear guidelines about how investigations should be conducted, by whom, what is the timeline that has to be followed, how investigation findings are reported, and so forth. Then on the recommendation, we submitted the same curriculum after the department needs to be reviewed to verify that it's adequate to the prevention of torture, that it needs to be policy developed to give effect to the prevention of torture. In respect of the role of the judicial inspector, very briefly, we submit that it is high time that we look at extending the mandate of the inspector to include investigative powers, similar to those of the independent complaint directorate, or what is now becoming the independent police investigative directorate. The inspector conduct such investigations. The McCallum case has already been dealt with, and in respect of the combating of torture law, as the Thistle has already alluded to, this has been coming on for several years, and we submit that this committee engaged with the Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development to see that that will be brought before Parliament as soon as possible. But that we maintain that such a piece of legislation must not be restricted only to the criminalisation of torture, but to the aim of the successful implementation of the Convention in its entirety. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much indeed, Chair, and thanks, Speaker. I just want to really confine myself to two issues. The one is your contention that torture includes the omission or the actions that officials could reasonably have foreseen. Now, as I understand it, the current working definition of torture in the combating of torture bill does
not provide for that. In other words, as I understand it, torture has been classed as any act or omission by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted by a public official on a person, etc., etc. In other words, there must be the intention that was the outcome. I'd just like your comment on the draft definition in contained in the bill and whether that is sufficient given your analysis of what constitutes torture. And secondly, you asked this before, I think. The recommendation that you made before that the judicial inspectors have investigative powers hasn't got the capacity. What will it require in order to give it the capacity to be able to take on that responsibility? Should that then also, if you recollect when we were debating the directional matters amendment law, should that then also extend to other places where awaiting trial, particularly remand detainees, are incarcerated? Thank you.
No, thank you. I want to ask this question directly to Mr. How to determine the necessary force? Where do you draw the line? Is it the explanation from the Department of Justice that comes from more than 2 minutes?
What? Your recommendation around the inspection that's been given investigative power. Over and above what Mr. Sapa has already raised. Remember, we are preparing for a meeting with the department and Parliament here. The question will be raised, why do they need it when we have tests? Why do they need it when we have tests? Should we not, as we've been saying, on all the other questions that we've been raising, fix our tests capacity? Just respond, what would be the benefit of the judicial inspectors? I'm not for or against it, I'm just raising the point. And then on your comment about a single conviction, or successful conviction that taken place, we agree with is that not because of what Mandela is saying, the whole body and everybody else, that because we don't have effective monitoring mechanism, it's my word as the inmate versus the official, and in most cases a group of officials work. It would be very difficult for somebody to win that case as an inmate. And then finally, what is missing for me is the aspect of education. Because for me, information is power. Part of the prevention of this type of thing is when inmates know their rights in terms of this type of thing. Because if they don't know their rights, officials currently would have the balance of power in terms of they are in charge, they can deny access to all these type of things. But nobody seems to be thinking that this is what would happen in terms of empowering inmates as opposed to. Well, I mean, this is one of it, but it takes the parole scenario as well. Inmates don't know what their rights are on parole, and that's what those things are. So it's just about empowering inmates to also be their own guardian in terms of their rights, not being captured upon. Thanks. If you want to comment on any of those, we'll tell you that the first time, and then everybody else will join.
So I think what we need to look at in the bill council for Parliament is to explain critically, and I ask for what definition of convention in the bill. It's one can expand on that, but the advice in the committee in culture is stick to the essential elements. There's four requirements. I think, yes, there might be intentionality, it might be active, but that's not thought by activity. But you cannot ignore it when officials are indifferent, deliberately indifferent to particular situations. So my advice is we look at the number of incidents that happen, I think one can then look at what the IEE currently requires and see if they have enough. One can also look at what the type of skills are required, whether it's forensic, whether it's normal, investigative type of skills. But I think we work after the architecture to what it is that you need. I don't think it's a money issue. I think the figures that have been mentioned in relation to the state liability, provincial liability, in respect of the plans being made, then I think it will actually save the state money, spend a little bit more money if we can reduce the number of plans being made. Obviously, the inspector would then, I'm not sure the all the details of facility sentence and unsentence falls under the inspector's mandate. It would then, yeah, I won't have to exactly, but then the company, and there's a few times the further charges get reported, they're there under the DTS. On the issue of necessary force, I think there's a lot in the literature about what constitutes necessary force. There's been a lot written in Africa about what constitutes necessary force. It is essentially the amount of force required to save life in a situation. It's been defined as the act, and I think in the Correctional Services Act, it's better defined than what it is in the criminal procedure. Mr. Sussex asked about why don't we let captains in? I think the first issue is that track record in investigating crimes committed inside prison is incredibly poor. So that it's not a reliable investigative power. Secondly, I think among the prison population, that lacks legitimacy, and they prisoners would probably be very resistant to assisting them with the investigations for fear of being victimized or that information being shared with indicated officials and so on. The issue of evidence around assault and possibly the use of CCTV, my recollection is that many of these assaults when they are committed by officials inside the cells or in the courtyard and the hallway, where we are already supposed to have CCTV in many prisons. The question should then rather be asked, well, where is that evidence? Why is that not being presented to the courts? And I think they are operational as 66 prisons. As a first argument, if you're obviously prisoners must know what their rights are, and then there are visits to prison that are properly briefed on those rights, and we know that that is not being done at the moment, it's being done in an inconsistent manner, it's not being done in the same way across the European Union.
Any other comments?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make a comment on your question about why can't that do it, and then just to link that to the oversight mechanism. I think that is not an independent entity. It is government. And when you're looking at the oversight mechanism, I think it's very important for this mechanism to be independent. And right now, there is also a contention around the Judicial and Correctional Services. I don't know, in terms of its link to the DCS itself. So when we look at that structure, when you're talking about how we need to restructure and strengthen these mechanisms, I think we need to have a separate deliberation around that. Because this is such an important body when it comes to monitoring of these stuff and prevention. Where we said we're going to look at changing its function, not just reactive, but preventative, and all of that. And can I make a few other comments now? Just broadly in terms of that.
I was going to, because of time,
looking at the different factors and wondering if we cannot perform your own one to when we meet the department, call you there, unless there's something that you really want to share about now. I'm just afraid you all do justice. Depending on your response, then I'll allow for people to make certain comments. If you want to make a very brief input, but we won't spend time on it. If there's something you really want to discuss today, we'll allow you to do that. Otherwise, we can engage with you and engage with the department at that time with you. But maybe we should give you 5 minutes for a minute just to say something so that you don't feel that you're coming in and putting this extension. 5 minutes. Absolutely happy. Yes, I shall. All right, in that sense, then we'll allow this side of the house, whoever wants you to make, we've got 10 minutes or so to make a comment or two, and we will be capturing those to empower us in our engagement with the department later. So, give you the first one now.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chair. Since we're able to just talk broadly to the presentations, I think what's very important then, what I've seen as we continue to deliberate, is the understanding of the definition of culture. I think it's very important that you're clear as to what culture is. There is a legal difference between culture and ill treatment, but in a convention, obviously, we're looking broadly at ill treatment and culture. So I think just in the mind of us who deliberate over it, I think it's very, we need to be very clear as to how we engage with this definition and we understand it. So in other words, like when the incident of it overcrowding torture, I think we need to really be clear as to what is torture, and then there's also other criminal acts and many treatments and dealing treatments. But anyway, just, I think I didn't mention the whole issue about the oversight mechanisms. I just wanted to ask a question about the cooperation between the Human Rights Commission and the Judicial Inspectorate of Prisons, and how are these oversight mechanisms collaborating and working together to improve that and strengthen that capacity around the issues of oversight. And I think we really talked about the criminalization of torture and DCS policy, but I think broadly, to go back to talking about addressing the root causes of torture and other ill treatment, in the optional protocol we do refer in the implementation manual to addressing root causes of torture and other ill treatment, but they don't go into detail as to what is the root causes. And I think if you look at South Africa, if you look at our discussion about the constitution, we do not, ordinary citizens are not involved in the human rights culture in this country. We have this constitution, but it's just not working because we don't live it. And I think that's very important on a long-term preventative point. And the model for our fabric of our society, we know the violence, we know the mental health problems, and a whole lot of other issues that lead into the recruitment of DCS officials, the professionalization of DCS, the body and the sector. So I think we mustn't exclude this discussion being very important due to all the other deliberations we've been having around issues of the country on a macro level. And we can't kind of, when we look at this issue, we need to look at it much broader. And I think Mr. Milton's point, just one second more, about rehabilitation, I think that's the important issue. When it says best practice, is that when inmates understand their rights and are developed, look at rehabilitation, that's what it does in terms of changing the individual behavior. We do know that in this country, rehabilitation is a problem. So let's put it as much broader.
I think we must do that, and we will call you again and have that discussion.
I do also think that all of us, including the department, will have to think about this campaign on education for training on whether it's the inmates or the official and so on. I just think that talking and ending up here is not helping. We need to find mechanisms of taking this into the people so that they are able to utilize it. And then on your one, Vanessa, around cooperation, I don't think it's just the Human Rights Commission and the portfolio committee does this, as I indicated, the judiciary does this. We just need to find a way of saying, what is the end game of all of this? When we come back from these things, both from a preventative and also from an investigative part of it, what do we do after we tell them? And I think that has been lacking. And we will apply our minds and maybe just find a way of dealing with this independent of the fact. And I take your point that these oversights should be as independent as possible. We will take that point when we fight with the department, we talk to the department and everybody else. And of course, we take your point that the electronic, the usage of electronic constraint devices needs to be reduced on the basis that we talk about. If you can see them without the type of the good department, they might have their views, but I think you got our support in the committee around this. So once again, all of you, thank you very much. These things help us a great deal when we deal with the department. So much so that they come and fire us whenever we talk to you guys. They make sure they send their people here to listen, but it's fine because we're discussing. So thank you very much. We will continue the discussion, and where possible, we implement comments. Captain Calvin, that came to observe from the media or anywhere else, thank you very much. And you're very welcome to become excited to spread this word to all South Africans. So the meeting is adjourned, and we won't see the rest of you, I think, until the new year. So we're wishing you all the best for the festive season, and may 2012 be better than 2011. Meeting